held between Hamas and Russia this year. The two sides had their meetings amid simmering tensions between Moscow and Tel Aviv. Relations between Russia and Israel have taken a turn for the worse since the beginning of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine. Israel blatantly expressed its opposition to the Russian move, stating that it considers the military action a violation of international law. Moscow, on the other hand, hit back, saying Israel is trying to divert attention from the Palestine-Israel conflict.
Russia, Putin just finally got enough with Israel's playing around. Russia has a big commitment because there's a lot of Russian Jews in Israel. But at some point, they're not getting their pensions now because of the Western sanctions. And Israel's bombing in Syria constantly, and now you've got it invading Gaza, that it's just, it's beyond the pale. And then Israel turns around and votes against Russia in the UN Human Rights Council, which is just another slap in the face, the horrors that Israel perpetuates all the time and gets away with there. So, yes, this is a moment where Russia's finally going back to its roots, which were after 48, when it played with Israel. It got burnt and it went for a moral position to support the Palestinians. And that's where Russia's returning to now. So it's an exciting moment.
Israel's hawkish stance against Russia may backfire on the regime. For starters, Russia is a UN veto-wielding member, and it can go against Israel. Furthermore, Russia's pro-Hamas stance can spread to other resistance groups, and this could translate into military support, something Israel would vehemently oppose. While Tel Aviv has been able to get away with violating Palestinian rights, now it has to worry about Hamas military action against it. And this may end up being very costly for it. Israel's remarks around the Ukraine conflict, where it slammed Russia, saying its actions are a violation of international law, have sparked anger in Moscow. And this while Russia says Israeli mercenaries are fighting side by side with the Ukrainians against the Russians only worsens the already simmering tensions. Relations between Moscow and Tel Aviv have also soured following Israel's continued airstrikes in Syria, despite criticism from Moscow. But could all this mean that Israel has given up on ties with Moscow and may even be looking for confrontation with Russia?
Israel is already confronting Russia. It was the reason behind a Russian plane being shot down. With Israel playing its tricks in the air. And this is a continual onslaught against Syria, against the Syrian government that Russia is supporting, and Russia is trying to stabilize Syria, get rid of ISIS. Israel is playing games there. It's trying to undermine Russia and Assad. And it's actually supporting ISIS at some points, along with the U.S., with its dirty tricks. So I really think that Russia, it's very much like the situation in Ukraine. Russia, Putin has been very low-key and very restrained in Ukraine. It could have blasted right from the start and killed tens of thousands and forced to surrender, but it didn't, because Ukrainians are almost Russians. And Putin didn't want that. But because of what the U.S. is doing and because of Zelensky, it's turned into a bloodbath. Well, that's exactly the same kind of situation that you see in Syria. And Israel is promoting the bloodbath. So let's hope that Russia finally against Israel. It should have done a long time ago.
Degrading ties between Moscow and Tel Aviv have, however, sparked fresh hope for the Palestinians to become a powerful member of the international community that can upgrade its resistance against the years-long Israeli oppression, aggression, and blockades. This would also fly in the face of the U.S. side, which has staunchly supported Israel. The events of September 11, 2001 shook the world. People watched across the globe as newsreels showed a Boeing 767 crash into the North Tower of the World Trade Center just before 9 a.m. in what initially appeared to be a terrible accident. When a second plane crashed into the South Tower 18 minutes later, it became clear that this was an attack. A third plane also crashed into the Pentagon just outside Washington, D.C., and a fourth plane crashed into rural Pennsylvania. 3,000 people were immediately killed in these attacks. Al-Qaeda, which was a terrorist network led by bin Laden, was quickly identified as being responsible for the 9/11 attacks, and the Taliban housed Al-Qaeda during those times. Within 10 days of the attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush initiated America's so-called War on Terror and began its invasion of Afghanistan. In 2001, both Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were driven out of the Afghan capital in a matter of months, so the U.S. strategy soon shifted from combat to what it said was stabilizing and rebuilding the country. 10 years after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, President Barack Obama announced that Osama bin Laden was dead, but U.S. troops stayed in the country, mostly supporting the government in Kabul through air power and training Afghan troops. While the U.S. presence seemed fruitful at first, across the rural countryside, support for the Taliban gained ground. This was mainly because of the U.S.'s massive campaign of airstrikes and bombings, much of which have had high civilian death tolls. So in essence, the Taliban had been defeated, yet the American presence brought them back from the dead. In 2021, despite America's longest war in history, the world witnessed Taliban forces sweeping through districts and gaining control of the country, and the U.S. suddenly removing its troops only facilitated the process. All this, from the U.S.'s inability to stabilize the country to its disastrous pullout, has led to questions regarding Washington's aims in Afghanistan and how it truly failed there.
Well, basically, we went into Afghanistan allegedly in response to 9/11 to find bin Laden and to kill him or to bring him to justice. We never did. And when ultimately bin Laden was found, he was not in Afghanistan. When the initial troops had been established there, there was a shift then to what might be called nation building. That is, we felt that Afghanistan should not be a home for terrorism, should not be a safe haven. Therefore, we will transform it in our own image. And this was the first sign of trouble. And we fought a war that went on for 20 years that we ultimately lost. And we withdrew with our tail between our legs as a result of a mistaken policy and a mistaken philosophy to begin with, that we could have changed other countries without knowing anything about their culture, their language, or their way of life. And that was the ultimate mistake. It led to devastation in Afghanistan.
The war on terror began more than 20 years ago by the Bush administration, with the main goal of rooting out terrorism. But the world has witnessed that it has been a complete and utter disaster, and now it is widely believed that it has led to an increase in the number of global terrorist organizations. Reports show that since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001, terrorist organizations have almost doubled. The so-called War on Terror also gave birth to the U.S. Authorities for Use of Military Force, or the AUMF, a law that has so far drained billions of dollars out of the American people's pockets and reshaped U.S.'s foreign policy. The U.S. also used the AUMF to invade Iraq, but after years of conflict, it seems that this was all essentially a way to provide additional unilateral power to the executive branch, one which allows the U.S. to wage war and engage in conflict across the globe. While the U.S. claimed that it aimed to make the world a safer place, it has in fact done the opposite and made the world much less safe. The U.S. war on terror goes beyond the U.S. failure in Afghanistan. Terrorism has actually endured in the broader West Asia, North Africa, and South Asia regions. Today, the number of attacks and victims worldwide are 3 to 5 times higher annually than in 2001. Yet the safety of the world is now under danger by the country who set out to make the world a safer place, namely the US and its continuing warmongering aspirations. the U.S. is on a war footing with nuclear-armed countries like Russia and China. It has threatened countries like Iran militarily. Thousands dead, millions displaced, and trillions of dollars wasted are all consequences of what the U.S. says is a war on terror.
The war on so-called war on terror was meant to keep the world safe for, you know, American control over world politics. You saw what happened in Afghanistan. I mentioned with the situation, the war in Iraq, there was a decision made. The use of U.S. military policy simply to ensure control of the United States over the world economy and over the political world is now in danger of becoming a conflict which could really end mankind. So that's the kind of thing we're facing today, and to the extent that people begin to understand that more clearly.
Iran's top general has warned of the ramifications of the growing military coordination between the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, and the Israeli military, saying the Islamic Republic interprets the development as a direct threat to its national security. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghdadi, wrote in an online message that the terrorist U.S. military has tried to compensate for the withdrawal of its aircraft carriers, helicopter carriers, and destroyers from the Persian Gulf and the Oman Sea by connecting the child-killing Israeli military to CENTCOM.
The meaning of this action is that, from our point of view, the spying and even operational facilities of the United States and its allies will be at the disposal of the occupying Zionist regime, and this will increase the threat to our beloved country.
In his message, Baghdadi also said the regional countries that host American forces have already received written warnings from Iran, which sees the U.S. presence in the region as a serious threat.
In addition to written announcements, warnings, and conveyance of the message through the foreign ministry to countries hosting the U.S. Army, we have declared and will declare our readiness and warning through expanding our presence, including air and sea patrols, deepening our intelligence dominance, and conducting various naval, missile, and drone exercises.
The top Iranian general further said, Iran's friendly advice to neighboring countries is to uphold brotherly relations and cooperation to establish security in the region by our own countries and not by relying on foreigners. Israel moved from U.S. European Command to CENTCOM in September of last year with the aim of simplifying the cooperation with American occupation forces in the region. The move is also expected to expand military coordination between the Israeli regime and sub-Arab countries, which began to normalize their relations with the regime in Tel Aviv under U.S. brokered agreements in late 2020.
So this is really a response by the West, by the U.S., British, Canadian, Australian, Five Eyes military alliance, in an almost nervous reaction to their failed operations in the Middle East, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya to Syria, but they're also now seeing their failure in Ukraine, which is going to result in tremendous political uprisings that most likely will overthrow the ruling regimes in Europe. So I think Israel and the United States may very well try and open up a new military front against Syria, against Iran, using Iraq as a proxy, and this is the first step in that strategy.
Late last month, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs Benny Gantz made an unprecedented visit to the headquarters of the U.S. Central Command in Florida. During the visit, Gantz claimed that Israel's cooperation with CENTCOM and the countries of the region is a game-changer in confronting Iran, adding that Israel and the U.S. will continue to deepen cooperation against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, which he charged was aimed at obtaining a nuclear weapon, a baseless accusation that Tehran has time and again rejected. Washington has also been working to improve ties between Israel and its neighbors under the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. The deal, commonly described as normalizing relations and establishing formal diplomatic ties between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, and Israel. At its heart, a business deal, the Abraham Accords facilitated financial investment between the countries as well as military and surveillance cooperation. Palestinian leaders, activists, and ordinary people have repeatedly rejected Arab-Israeli normalization deals as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people.
The shifting political powers in Europe and the world and the Middle East are driving the Israeli reaction. Very clearly, the pendulum of political power is shifting away from the United States and Britain and Israel, and it is shifting into Asia. So you have Russia, India, Iran, China emerging as the powerhouse countries. And Israel recognizes that the Middle Eastern regimes of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, they are all shifting to seek better relations with Russia. That being said, Israel is quickly accelerating its military plans to try and bluff and seem like it is a threat. But I think at heart, it recognizes these Middle Eastern regimes of the Wahhabi Sunni kingdoms have no political loyalty whatsoever.
Normalization is the way for the current regimes to establish their foundations and fight their peoples by transforming the battle in our region from a struggle for Palestinian and Arab rights to supporting the ambitions and plans of the occupation.
In the limelight.
Last Sunday marked the anniversary of 9/11, which paved the way for the U.S. to invade and plunder West Asia and North Africa region under the excuse of countering terrorism. The U.S., which is a terrorist regime itself, named this exploitation as the Global War on Terror, which had nothing to do with countering terrorism. Rather, it was a tactic for draining the resources of countries under its occupation. And the worst thing is that all those who committed these crimes were never held accountable. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for the first part. Global Times wrote, "Over the past 21 years, the U.S., under the banner of counterterrorism, has waged wars overseas and caused tremendous suffering to the people of other countries. However, the U.S. not only failed to export its democratic system to the West Asian countries or eradicate terrorism, but at home, they have been faced with rising extremism in political and social spheres." This is iconic, given the U.S. tendency of wantonly engaging in military aggression and pursuing hegemony. The 9/11 attacks opened the curtain of the U.S. so-called global counterterrorism war. In the name of making itself safer, Washington scorched the land of other countries, like Iraq and Afghanistan. Through fighting terrorism overseas, the U.S. government also forcefully promoted U.S.-style democracy, only causing greater turmoil and human rights crisis in those countries. On the other hand, wherever the U.S. military goes, it seeks opportunities to gain material benefits like controlling the local resources. The U.S. has recently stepped up efforts to steal oil from Syria. And over the years, Washington has overthrown several governments in the region that resisted its hegemony. Thank you. Global Times wrote, "The U.S. war on terror has been a complete failure. It has failed to make the American people feel safer." Domestically, a report released in 2021 revealed that 20 years of post-9/11 wars had cost the U.S. an estimated $8 trillion. Instead of spending the sum on improving infrastructure and people's livelihood, addressing domestic issues and achieving social solidarity, such large amounts of money has been used to destabilize the world. This has impaired many Americans' confidence toward their country, and it contributed to the social division and political polarization of recent years in the U.S. The U.S. theft of Syria's oil serves as another example of how the U.S. resorts to whatever means to benefit itself in operations in the West Asia, North Africa region. In fact, plundering the energy of other countries is U.S. real purpose. Syria's oil theft by the U.S. plainly exposed the real purpose of U.S. foreign military intervention for the sake of economic profit. The U.S. presents itself as a kind of world police. It's the source of a large part of the world's turmoil and suffering. Because of the involvement of the U.S. in various parts of the world, humanitarian disasters have occurred in different regions, and many refugees are still wandering to find a home. It can be concluded that the U.S. decision-making elites are not interested in the well-being of either the American people nor the people of other countries, and they are certainly not interested in promoting genuine democracy to eradicate the root of terrorism. What they really care about is plundering resources around the world in whatever name they choose, be it democracy, freedom, or fighting terrorism. RT, in an op-ed, wrote, "This year marks the 21st anniversary of September 11, 2001 attacks on the U.S. Last year, the U.S. and the world marked the 20th anniversary of 9/11. What made this date more important than the simple passage of time was that it was relevant. The 2021 event marking America's entry into what was to become known as the so-called global war on terrorism occurred less than a month after America's ignominious retreat from Afghanistan. The Kabul evacuation of August 2021 was the final act in a two-decade-long drama which saw the vision of a new American century espoused by an American neoconservative elite who looked to exploit the horror of 9/11 by turning it into a catalyst for world domination. Run aground on the shoals of geopolitical reality, capsizing and ultimately sinking in a self-created storm of national hubris. The America that emerged from the 20-year policy disaster that was the war on terrorism, comprised of several distinct conflicts, including Afghanistan and perhaps most notably Iraq, was chastened and humiliated, but not defeated or humbled. There is a dichotomy between the geopolitical reality that the United States found itself in after 20 years of global neglect, while squandering the nation's blood, treasure, and reputation in the deserts and mountains of the West Asia, North Africa region, and the narcissistic arrogance of an American leadership elite unable and or unwilling to recognize the damage they had done to the American enterprise, and as such nullified their collective utility in crafting appropriate diplomatic, economic, and security strategies for recovery. 9/11 at 20 plus 1 is the first anniversary of this new reality.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, features of a good speech. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the features of a good speech in the Islamic lifestyle. We see that the Islam has given importance to the speaking and to the speech, and it says that you must speak in a good way, in a good manner. And the things even when you say should be the truth. And therefore, there are some features of that. The first thing, the first feature of a good speech is that the person who says things, he thinks about them before he speaks. So it says like, you know, we say that think before you speak. So this is the first importance, this is the first feature of a good speech, that behind a good speech, every good speech, there is a thinking process. There is a people, like the people, when they want to say something, they first think about it, whether to say it or not. And after that, when they obviously judge the things or the environment, and then they say the things, and they use the words which are effective. So this is the result of thinking. We have narrations like, for example, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that, فَكِّرْ ثُمَّ تَكَلَّمْ تَسْلَمْ مِنَ الذَّلَلْ, that you need to think before, first think, and then you should say something, you should speak. And it saves you from you know, having a bad speech or from having a bad effect. So it keeps you safe from the hardship. On the other hand, we have another hadith where it is said like لِسَانُ الْعَاقِلِ وَرَاءَ قَلْبِهِ, the tongue of an intellectual is behind his heart. He thinks first and then he speaks. وَقَلْبُ الْأَحْمَقِ وَرَاءَ لِسَانِهِ, and the heart of a dumb person is behind his tongue. He says things and after that he thinks that what I have said. So we should be careful when we say something, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the features of a good speech in the Islamic lifestyle. We said the first feature is that we think before we speak. The second feature in the Islam is that the speech should be in accordance with the Islamic ethics. Means that a person who performs the wajibat or the things that are obligatory and he stops himself from performing the forbidden things, the haram or muharramat, such a person, when he speaks something, obviously his speech has an effect on the others. He will have whenever he talks, people listen to him, and obviously this is very important that we become the true servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And after that, whenever we say something, it will have effects on the hearts of the people, because the hearts of the people is in the hands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He gives
he brings the attraction of our speech in their heart, and people start loving what we say. So these are in the hands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The third feature is that the person, whenever he speaks, he must be a truthful person. The only wordings are not important. The action is also important, that a person in his actions is a truthful person. So whenever people see him, whenever people wants to talk about him, they remember him as a truthful person. We know that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam was known as the Amin, the trustworthy, and the Sadiq, which is truthful. And therefore people have said, like, if Muhammad says, like, there is a caravan behind this mountain, even if there is no one there, we will believe in him. Why? Because he's a truthful and trustworthy. And this is very important, that the features, one of the features is that a person practically shows that he's not a liar. He is a truthful person. He's a trustworthy person. And therefore, it will have effects on the hearts of the people, on the listeners, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the U.S., the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee has vowed to investigate corruption allegations in President Donald Trump's Justice Department. Please stay with us for more. In the U.S., the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee has vowed to investigate corruption allegations in former President Donald Trump's Justice Department. Details of the story are given in the website salon.com. The Senate Judiciary Committee announced on Monday, 12th of September, that it will probe former federal prosecutor Jeffrey Berman's claim that former President Donald Trump and Attorney General Bill Barr sought to pressure federal prosecutors to go after Trump's perceived enemies. Judiciary Chairman Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, said in a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland that the panel will investigate claims of astonishing and unacceptable deviations by Department of Justice officials to pursue partisan prosecutions and William Barr's efforts to replace Berman with a Trump loyalist. Berman's claims indicate multiple instances of political interference, Dick Durbin wrote, calling on the Department of Justice to produce all documents and communications related to Berman's claims. It violated all the norms and traditions of the Department of Justice, which is supposed to be independent from politics, Berman told MSNBC's Rachel Maddow on Monday. He said, Trump turned the department into his own personal law firm. He put in people who would do his bidding. And they would, you know, target Trump's political enemies and assist Trump's friends. And it was a disgrace. Berman, a Republican former Trump transition official who served as a U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York until he was fired by Donald Trump in June of 2020, wrote in his upcoming book, holding the line that he resisted the worst of the attempted interference, whether from main justice or from the White House, according to an excerpt published by the New York Times. Berman was fired by Donald Trump after he refused William Barr's request for him to resign after he led the prosecutions of multiple Trump allies, drawing allegations of corruption at the Department of Justice. Berman wrote that William Barr pushed his office to drop its prosecution of former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen, who was ultimately convicted on 8 federal charges, including campaign finance violations that he claimed were on behalf of Donald Trump. Berman told ABC News that Department of Justice officials also pressured his office to remove references to Donald Trump from Michael Cohen's indictment. On the eve of Michael Cohen's guilty plea, Main Justice tried to get our office to remove any reference to individual one, who was President Donald Trump, he said. They were unsuccessful in that venture, and they were unsuccessful in every attempt to politically interfere with our office. We held the line in every instance. Berman also claims that Justice Department officials pressured his office to prosecute former State Secretary of State John Kerry. Donald Trump publicly called for John Kerry to be prosecuted over claims that he discussed the nuclear deal with Iranian leaders while Donald Trump was in office. When Berman declined to prosecute John Kerry, Department of Justice officials asked another U.S. attorney's office, which likewise declined, according to Berman. That was truly outrageous, Berman told ABC News on Monday. President Trump attacks John Kerry in 2 tweets, saying that Kerry engaged in possible illegal conversations with Iranian officials regarding the Iran nuclear deal. The very next day, the Trump Justice Department refers the John Kerry criminal case to the Southern District of New York. 2 tweets by the president and the John Kerry criminal case becomes a priority. Berman also claimed that Department of Justice officials told his deputy to charge Democratic lawyer Greg Craig ahead of the 2018 midterm elections to even things out. Craig was ultimately prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C., but was acquitted by a jury in less than 5 hours of charges that he misled the Department of Justice about his lobbying work for Ukraine. The Justice Department told us, "Hey, you have just indicted 2 allies of President Trump, Chris Collins, who is a Republican congressman from upstate New York, and Michael Cohen, who was the president's lawyer and fixer. And it's time for you guys to even things out and indict a Democrat before the midterm elections," Berman told ABC News. "It was something we had never heard before or seen before." The Bloomberg News Agency also covers the same story from a different perspective. The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee vowed to investigate allegations in a new book that President Donald Trump's Justice Department demanded that critics of the president be prosecuted. These reported claims indicate astonishing and unacceptable deviations from the department's mission to pursue impartial justice, which requires that its prosecutorial decisions be free from political influence, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois wrote in a letter on Monday to Attorney General Merrick Garland, asking for information regarding the allegations. Senator Dick Durbin's concerns center around the book Holding the Line by Jeffrey Berman, the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, whose ouster 2 years ago raised questions about political interference in a set of investigations into Donald Trump, his companies, and people close to him. If accurate, Jeffrey Berman's claims indicate multiple instances of political interference in the department's investigative and prosecutorial decisions, Senator Durbin said. He added, The Senate Judiciary Committee will certainly investigate these episodes. Jeffrey Berman stepped down in June of 2020 during an acrimonious and public confrontation with the then Attorney General William Barr. At the time, Jeffrey Berman said he stepped down only after being told that a trusted deputy would succeed him, and in light of Attorney General William Barr's decision to respect the normal operation of law. The Justice Department confirmed that it had received Senator Durbin's letter but declined further comment. William Barr on Monday night declined to comment on the book, which is scheduled to be published on Tuesday. The Senate panel investigation would add to the list of legal challenges facing the former president. The Justice Department has subpoenaed dozens of campaign operatives and allies of Donald Trump as part of a broad effort to collect information relating to the plot to overturn the 2020 presidential election, according to people familiar with the matter.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyyah on August 30th, 2022. One of the most important issues that religion pursues is the creating awareness in people. It removes neglect from them. It takes away their forgetfulness and their forgetful nature. Events have taken place before our eyes. Now, some of you young people may have not witnessed these events, or you may not remember them clearly. Those important history-making events, the excitement of the people at the beginning of the revolution, the confession and astonishment of the arrogant powers in the face of this great movement that was unexpected for them, and then the start of the hostility and the different things that happened to the nations one after another. These things should be remembered. We must realize the situation we are in.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The skies of Tehran were occupied by Saddam's planes, and we had no way to confront them. Their pilot would sit inside a fighter plane and pass over Tehran without having to worry about anything. And we weren't able to do anything. They would either drop bombs or break the sound barrier to ridicule the Iranian nation. That was the situation our skies were in, on the ground, in the alley, and in the streets. There were terrorism. They would go into people's homes and assassinate them. They'd assassinate soldiers, businessmen, and shopkeepers. Widespread insecurity prevailed all over the country. We're not going to forget these. These things have passed, and the Iranian nation and the system of the Islamic Republic overcame them with power and honor. Let us not forget the ups and downs. Let us not forget the blunders, the unpleasants, the ups and downs, the performance of government from the beginning of the revolution until today, the different ways that government have performed, the parliament and the likes of these.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
With record inflation already established and long-term recession looming, few could deny that Europe's sanctions war on Russia has backfired economically so far. A new poll from a top French TV news channel has found that the French have become extremely pessimistic about the conflict in Ukraine and increasingly fed up with the price they have to pay for a country which is not even a part of the European Union or the Eurozone. The poll found that almost 60% want the sanctions on Russia to stop or be reduced if they have too big an impact on the average French person's purchasing power.
Les sanctions et de façon irresponsable et anti-économique.
These sanctions are totally irresponsible from an economic and social point of view. Russia is the only one benefiting from the sanctions, and they've made incredible profits on the increase in oil prices. This is not a situation which can last, given the poor economic state of France and the Eurozone.
France is split almost 50-50 on the question of, has military and financial aid to Ukraine been effective? Almost 85% of those polled think the war will drag on for years.
Je parle des Américains surtout qui poussent. Les Européens, ils suivent comme...
The situation is that the Americans are pushing and the Europeans are following. Not one American is dying in this war, and they have all the energy they need, unlike Europe. Europe needs to say, no, war is not a solution. And if they don't say this, soon their economies are going to be smashed and the average person is going to be quite angry with their leaders.
The poll goes against the stated positions of Brussels, Paris, and France's mainstream media moguls, but the economic difficulty of the French working class is extremely hard to suppress. There were over 100 arrests in Paris last weekend at a protest of the economic-based Yellow Vest movement. Many wonder if the French will increasingly brave well-known police and judicial repression in order to protest an unequal economy which appears certain to only worsen. After the coronavirus pause, the Yellow Vests have been marching nationwide every Saturday since their season two began in October of 2021. However, French mainstream media have essentially had a blackout on the group since June 2019. While Europe is warning that energy shortages are likely to produce a winter of frosty discontent, the new poll shows a majority of France had already grown weary of sanctions on Russia by the twilight of summer. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Members of the British-led Commonwealth could amount a mass exodus of the bloc following the death of British royal Queen Elizabeth II. With republican movements gaining ground from Australia to the Bahamas, the new King Charles III could see his royal domain shrink below the current 14 countries he currently rules over.
Barbados was the last country to leave, becoming a republic just last year. Jamaica has also expressed a strong desire to follow suit with a referendum planned in 2025. On Monday, the Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda said that his nation should have a vote on whether they should keep the royal family as head of state within the next few years. Elsewhere, Australia and New Zealand have witnessed renewed calls for a public debate on the matter to decide what they should do going forward.
Founded in 1931, the Commonwealth is a collection of countries which were former dominions of the British Empire. Following the global demand for greater freedom, the Empire was forced to grant more independence to its remaining territories. The Commonwealth Charter claims the bloc works towards shared goals of prosperity, democracy, and peace. So why would so many member states be this seemingly eager to quit? Press TV asked Dr. Salman Butt for his thoughts.
I don't really think there's much commonwealth about it. I mean, it's a bunch of countries, unfortunately, that share one thing in common, which they've been completely destroyed and, you know, and terrorized by the same kind of empire. There is this underlying kind of neo-imperialist agenda and soft power that's being, you know, still being imposed on other countries, especially so-called, you know, third world countries, which, by the way, the reason why they're the third world now is because of, unfortunately, being systematically destroyed, deindustrialized, and kind of pillaged by empire, British Empire.
The new King and Queen are expected to launch a tour in 2023, visiting a number of Commonwealth nations in an attempt to combat the rise in anti-monarchy sentiment. Their performance could decide the fate of their shrinking royal realm. Robert Carter, Windsor.
Amid mutual accusations of obstructing the UN brokered truce, the UN Security Council called on both parties of the war in Yemen to urgently intensify peace talks in order to expand the truce that could translate into a durable ceasefire.
Reopening of the Sana'a airport and the port of Hodeidah fully and paying suspended salaries are basic conditions for reaching an extension of the armistice or a solution to a permanent ceasefire in Yemen. There is no longer a way to waive these conditions, as there are basic rights of the Yemeni people to feel that there is a real change and an improvement in the humanitarian situation.
Observers say the national delegation will likely reject the renewal of the truce since no progress has been made so far to find a solution regarding paying the government employees whose salaries are suspended since 2016 as a result of the Saudi war on Yemen.
The national delegation was refusing to extend the truce for the third time and did not agree until the mediation of Oman. At the time, an agreement was made regarding the unpaid salaries. Unfortunately, nothing has been achieved so far. Therefore, I think that the national delegation will not agree to extend the truce for a fourth time until radical solutions are found regarding the salaries.
The Security Council highlighted the tangible benefits of the UN brokered truce to the Yemeni people, including the flow of fuel through Hodeidah port. However, the Yemeni Petroleum Company says Saudi Arabia is still imposing restrictions on fuel imports.
Yemenis say the Saudi-led coalition has not fulfilled its commitments under the UN agreement over the past months. Therefore, the national delegation says it will continue the talks only to reach a solution that completely ends the war and siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Life is not yet hectic in central Berlin on an end of summer Monday. As Berliners gradually return to work, for many it is difficult not to turn on to the energy issues afflicting the country. The recent announcement by Russia to halt gas deliveries to Germany via the key pipeline Nord Stream 1 for an indefinite period has sparked fears of power shortages next winter and fueled inflation.
Of course I'm worried. The energy crisis is a pressing issue for all Germans. We're moving back to coal-powered plants, and just some of our nuclear power plants are likely to be kept online. And the soaring price of energy, how could I not be worried?
Germany has been trying to reduce its natural gas usage by 20% to avoid an energy shortage this winter. Some large cities in the countries are limiting heating and turning off gas lights to save on natural gas. Germany has decided to replace all Russian energy imports, most notably natural gas, by as soon as the end of 2024. Moscow accounted for 55% of Berlin's gas imports in 2021, a level that declined.